Hi, I'm Mikey, and I'm turning 10. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. Get your daddy.
Thank you very much, Mikey. That is my oldest son, Mikey Steven. He just turned 10 this week. How about that? Happy birthday, bud. We love you so much. And what a way to start off this edition of Outside the Loop. That's what you're listening to. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 962. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. And maybe you heard this week about a decision by Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson that has caused a bit of commotion. Earlier this week, the mayor asked city contractors to reduce their invoices by 3% to help cover Chicago's growing budget shortfall. He framed this as a necessary step to keep the city's finances in check, a way to do our part in tough times. But here's the question: who is actually being asked to sacrifice, and who can afford to take that hit? A 3% cut might not sound like much on paper, but let's think about the bigger picture here. Many of these city contractors aren't giant corporations rolling in profits. They're small and medium-sized businesses, often family-owned and often run by immigrants. And they employ thousands of hardworking Chicagoans. These are the electricians who keep our lights on, the construction crews who repair our streets, the cleaning staff who make sure our public buildings are safe. These are the people who have invested their sweat and savings into building a better future, not just for themselves, but for all of us. From Pilsen to Little Village, from Devon Avenue to Chinatown, immigrants have been the backbone of our city's workforce for generations. Many of these businesses already operate on razor-thin margins, and when the government contracts shrink, it's not the CEOs who feel the squeeze, it's the workers. It's the Latino-owned trucking company and the South Asian construction crew, the Polish drywall team, all of whom depend on these contracts to pay their workers and keep their businesses afloat. A 3% cut might mean the difference between keeping a full staff or having to let someone go. And let's not forget, costs aren't going down. Rent is still high, groceries are more expensive than ever, and the cost of doing business in Chicago just keeps climbing. And we have the Trump tariffs that are producing economic pain by increasing prices. If the city forces these businesses to tighten their belts, that cost will get passed down to workers, to families, to neighborhoods. So we have to ask, is this really the best way to balance the budget? Should we be putting this burden on the very people who make our city work? Or are there smarter, fairer ways to fix our financial problems? I mean, the mayor did open up the special mayoral gift room in City Hall to the public. Maybe we can sell off some of those items inside that gift room for some revenue. And as I've been saying for months, don't forget about my Chicago Italian beef barge plan that would float on the Chicago River. It's going to be something, I'm telling you. And today's show, it's all about hardworking people. We get an update from Chicagoland's immigrant community. We hear from a local jazz musician who has a new album coming out. And we learn the secret history of a funky, soulful vocalist from the mid-20th century from right here in Chicago. To paraphrase the great Donna Summer, you work hard for your money, so Chicago better treat you right. Right? Right. In a time when federal policies are increasingly hostile toward immigrant communities, the Center for Immigrant Progress, which is based in Chicagoland, stands as a beacon of hope, offering resources and programs that foster integration and uplift the voices of those they serve. Sandra Diaz is a co-founder and a board member at the Center for Immigrant Progress. It's an organization dedicated to empowering immigrants through education, advocacy, and community support. And she is here with us today to share some insights into how the organization is making a tangible difference in the lives of immigrants despite the challenging national climate. We could check out the website centerforimmigrantprogress.org. Sandra, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to have you here.
Hi. Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
A lot going on in the world. We'll get to that. But let's just start with how you go about what you do at the Center for Immigrant Progress. So you are interacting with this community, this immigrant community. And as we've seen in the news, many have come up to Chicago, but then also the surrounding suburbs. There are many immigrants in those areas as well. I said this is a crazy time, but can you just paint a picture for us? What are they feeling? What's the mood? What's the overall vibe right now from that community?
Yeah, well, I think it's a similar sentiment as, I guess, a lot of the country's experiencing. I think adding on the immigrant experience is just like an added stressor beyond that. So thinking about the immigrant community right now, I think they're are people who, you know, in general are feeling a lot of stress and anxiety and just uncertainty about the future and what that could look like for them and their loved ones and their community in general. Because when we say immigrant community, we don't just mean immigrants. We mean every other, you know, person that they touch and interact with and that, you know, make up a part of that community, which is not just immigrants, right? Like we are a part of the fabric of this country and interact with so many different sectors and other communities. So I think there is like an overall sentiment of just uncertainty and of fear right now.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point about the interaction of this community, because you're right. It's, I think, very easy to talk about this group like it's just in a silo. And that's not necessarily true, because immigrants interact with all of us all the time, every day. And you're right, they are really integral in parts of these communities and really help make these communities go and function. So is there a sense that some of these folks, some of these people who are in this immigrant community, are they retrenching? Are they not going out as much? Are they just trying to stay to themselves? Are they kind of disconnecting? Or is there more of a push to try to still have that integration?
Yeah, I think it's a mix. I want to say that we've seen people who are fearful of even going out to organizations like ours and seeking resources or asking for information, which is part of the reason why we try and make sure that everything we do, there is an accessibility feature of like making sure it's online at least somewhere for people who are fearful of stepping out. But I also think there are people who have been sort of empowered to just be more vocal. And I notice especially in the children of immigrants, you know, some who are citizens and are seeing the impact and how it's affecting their parents or loved ones. Also, I've seen this with a lot of educators when they've seen, you know, the effects that this can have, the fear can have on the children in schools, or, you know, hearing about the fear that the parents have as well. So I've seen, you know, leaders come up and feel like there is a need for them to advocate for those who may be fearful of speaking out in these times. So I think there's kind of a mix happening, but I do think that organizations like ours are doing a good job at making sure that we still keep our communities informed and those resources accessible to them, even if they're not comfortable, you know, stepping out as much as they used to.
Yeah, it's important to reach folks where they're at. You're absolutely right. And so in terms of the kinds of services that you do provide at the Center for Immigrant Progress, can you tell us about that? How do you go about the work? What does that look like practically?
Yeah, I think initially it's a lot of, you know, just those interactions with people, asking how they're doing, checking in. I think it's really beneficial to the work we do that, you know, we're an organization that was founded by immigrants and daughters of immigrants. So also the people, our team also have their own, you know, connections to the immigrant experience. So we have our own understanding of what is needed in within our community. And, you know, being able to interact with our community is also what informs what we do. So we realize that, you know, one of the most important things right now is making sure people have the right information from trusted sources. So we've seen a lot of like Know Your Rights presentations popping up. I think something that we've decided to do on top of just making sure people know what their rights are in the country, regardless of what their immigration status may be, is also making sure that there's a focus on creating community spaces, whether it's virtual or in person, and, you know, centering our community and our individual well-being, and being able to provide that space where we can sort of have just connection and make sure that, you know, we realize that we're not alone in this. A lot of people are feeling stressed right now. A lot of people are fearful, but we have each other. We have our community, and we try and create these spaces where we can kind of just like celebrate the joys, support each other, and just have that space, that safe space to support each other. Like I said, we try and keep the community informed, but not overwhelmed, because we know there's a lot going on. So we have our monthly newsletter where we try and inform people of everything that is going on and how it's going to be affecting them. But also on social media, I think it's been a really useful tool, especially recently, to make sure people know how to decipher, you know, what's factual and what's not, and how it could affect them or not. We also have a podcast where we try and inform people about, you know, all of the policies that may be affecting them, but also sharing in the stories of immigrants, so people can also, you know, get a look at what the experience is like, and also what immigrants look like. You know, we, like I mentioned, we are in all parts of our communities, in all parts of the country, and we are embedded into the fabric of this country. So making sure people know, you know, the very diverse stories that we have to share, and what makes us beyond just, you know, the label, you know, what makes us human, and getting that look into our lives as well. And then we also provide certain resources. We have scholarships for undocumented students and people who may need to renew their work permits. So making sure that there's not a financial barrier to have those things. And then also we have a leadership program, and this one, I believe, will be starting in April. So we just want to make sure that you know, the people who are looking to get involved in some way and you know, do their part, have guidance or support on how to do that and what that could look like. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be in the nonprofit sector, or, you know, it could be in any place, any career, how to be a support for our communities. And then lastly, we just try and make sure that we collaborate with other orgs that are also getting active right now, other groups that are looking to support our communities, and just making sure that we're collaborating and sharing resources and keeping everyone well informed.
And this is personal for you. I mean, you are a DACA recipient. You came to the U.S. when you were just 5 years old. So, you know, here you are, co-founder of the Center for Immigrant Progress. But I would just have to imagine this is a very deeply personal thing that you are working on here.
Yes, it is. And I mean, the reason I got involved was because I realized that there were people making decisions that were impacting my life. And I couldn't do anything or say anything, or, you know, I felt like I had no control. So I felt that very personally. I think it was around 2017 when DACA was rescinded for the first time under the first Trump administration, that I think I that's when I realized I should do something. You know, I should try and at least share my story, make sure people know that this is impacting real people, at least. And eventually it led to me getting involved with local organizations, and eventually met the ladies that helped create the Center for Immigrant Progress. And we all have that connection to the immigrant community and our own immigrant experiences. And I think it all stemmed from what we experienced, but also what we saw our parents experiencing, you know, people who, you know, come to this country and work hard and do everything they can to give their children the best life that they can, sometimes putting their needs aside to do so, their health aside to do so. And it's really disheartening to see how they are still treated as like second class citizens in this country. And so it's very personal. And I'm glad that I'm able to support my community in this way.
Well, you're doing some really powerful work, important work, and good luck with everything going forward. The website, centerforimmigrantprogress.org. And Sandra Diaz is the co-founder and board member at the Center for Immigrant Progress based in Lake County. Hey, Sandra, I really appreciate the time today. Again, good luck. Hang in there. And let's hope for a better tomorrow.
Thank you. Let's hope so. Thank you so much for the time.
Let's talk some local jazz right now from local jazz guitarist and music educator Steve Knight. His new album comes out April 11th and is called 4 Years Gone. That's F-O-R, 4 Years Gone. And he has a CD release set of shows on Monday, April 14th at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago at 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock p.m. We should all check out his website, stevenight.net. Steve, welcome to the show. Nice to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. It's a exciting opportunity to talk about something we're really pumped about.
A little bit about you. You're not originally from Chicago, so you've had a little bit of a journey to get here, which is cool.
That's the word.
So tell us how this all started for you. How did jazz kind of become the thing for you?
Sure. Well, I was in undergrad in Kansas at Emporia State University, which I assume nobody's heard of. And it's a small enough school that it didn't have a jazz program, had a music program, but not a jazz program. And I had played in some musical theater pits for the theater department. And the music department said, oh, you should be in the big band because you're the only guitar player that can read at our school, read, you know, kind of classic standard notation. And so I got into jazz when I was 20, and I kind of haven't looked back since then. We got to Chicago, my wife and I moved to Chicago in 2016 from New York, and found a home, and we are going to be here as long as the stars align.
Yeah, that's, well, we're glad that you're here. So, you know, coming from New York, that's a pretty significant music town too. So, you know, I don't want to get into the comparison. I think that's kind of crazy comparing New York and Chicago, but I'm more sure. Just curious about like what the scene is like there versus here when it comes to music and jazz specifically, because Chicago really has such a history when it comes to jazz music.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that there are plenty of, you know, there's great jazz in New York, obviously. It's kind of the capital of our world. And that being said, you know, when I have students ask about New York, I say, well, it's kind of like a tax on people who are bad at math. Because it is so expensive to live there that yeah. I couldn't make a living as a musician. And there are people that do. And I think that's rad. But, you know, we kind of, my wife and I started to look at the finances of a jazz life, which is, you know, not, you don't get into it for the money. Let's put it that way.
Sure, sure.
And Chicago has not only a lower cost of living, but both of us my wife and I met in Oklahoma when I was in graduate school. And so there's a Midwestern kind of neighborhood vibe to Chicago with enough of the big city kind of, frankly, gigs and places to play that it made a lot more sense for us than New York, in the same way that we wouldn't live in San Francisco, probably, in the same way. Super cool town. Would love to live there, but man, who could possibly afford to do that?
Right, you know? Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right about that. And you speak about the neighborhood feel, and I think you're absolutely correct about that. And I think, you know, maybe people are just a little bit more approachable, and maybe some of the music is more approachable. And, you know, you're gigging out. I mean, I was looking at your schedule. We've got these big shows that you have coming up here on Monday, April 14th at the Jazz Showcase. But I mean, you're playing every week fairly regularly.
Yeah, I'm trying to be a, you know, 150 or 200 gig a year type of musician. And that has, you know, and that's far and wide. That is the Jazz Showcase, which we are super excited about. I've never headlined the Jazz Showcase before, so that's exciting. But we also do, you know, corporate events and special events and neighborhood birthday parties and, you know, just kind of grinding it out. As somebody smarter than me said, you know, if you don't have a gig and somebody offers you a gig, you take it.
Right.
And in jazz particularly, that's true because you know, I got into jazz. The joke is I got into jazz because I don't like crowds. You know, but it's true. Yeah. And so yeah, we are very busy, which is a great blessing to have, but also it's with a record coming out, it's a little bit more intimidating / exciting. You know, because if somebody doesn't show up to my gig on Monday night at 7 p.m., that's not super fun, but I'll live. But it's, you know, most of those gigs aren't, hey, I put this new piece of art into the world and I would love to share it with you. You know, it's less rejection at a local bar on a Tuesday night than it is at the Jazz Showcase, you know.
Sure. But people are listening. I mean, I think there are so many venues, and I use that, I don't know, loosely, because, you know, these bars can become venues. You can kind of tuck into a corner with a trio and do your thing. Absolutely. on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and people are going to be there for it. And I think that's a special thing, especially post pandemic, that we can still say that in Chicago.
I think part of it, you know, I wasn't continued to be a teacher and teach private lessons and workshops and things like that. But there is something about the kind of communication of a performance and getting to know the community, both in, you know, kind of locally in your neighborhood, as well as the Chicago community. I did Jazz Thaw in Oak Park a couple weeks ago, and I was amazed at how many people I saw again, having done that event 3 or 4 years in a row. And so it does feel like a kind of a, if we kind of selected Chicago as our new home, that after being here for almost 10 years, it kind of starts to feel like we are part of Chicago now, as opposed to, you know, transplants necessarily.
And that's great. And I think, like you were saying before, the people, the vibe, that all plays into that overall feeling of familiarity and neighborhood connection, which I've always loved about this place. And the album, 4 Years Gone, this is exciting. So again, we want to say that, Steve Knight, you are playing at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago, Monday, April 14th, 8 o'clock and a 10 o'clock set. So tell us about this new record.
Sure. So we put out our first album in August of 2022, and it was the first album I had done as a leader. And, you know, now after the fact, I'm happy to admit that it was kind of a, I wonder if I can do this. Mm. You know, all of my heroes are recording artists, and it is both time and an investment and all those things. And so we put it out and we got good response. And so the next, this one, I suppose, is kind of we did it once. Now we want to do it with, how are we going to do it different? How are we going to look at this thing differently? And so this album ended up being a lot more non-original songs. We cover a Joni Mitchell song. We cover a Kenyon song. We cover a George Harrison song. So this one has a little bit more thematic alignment, I would say, in terms of the kind of themes of going. And the title track is a track that I kind of wrote without this in mind, but as I started to form it, ended up being kind of about my mom who passed away 4 years ago, and that kind of, what would you call it, ethos or thematic spine kind of went through all of the tracks and the way we produced it. And so we're really excited for the, I think it is a vulnerable record in a lot of ways, and you know, there's a excitement to share that, but also like you know, vulnerability is a little bit scary. I've got Justin Peterson on bass, who is the bass player from the first record, and another drummer in town, Leonard Stroud, is playing drums, and I couldn't be happier with their contributions. It is much easier to sound good when you're surrounded with people that are, you know, better than you, which is wonderful. I'm really, really, you know, team building 101, hire people that are smarter and better than you, you know?
Right. Everyone looks good in the end.
Exactly. So I just get to show up and play guitar, which is wonderful. It's I feel, you know, that's another thing about Chicago versus New York. I think the density of musicians is greater, but the levels of musicians are really the same. World-class musicians in Chicago are doing just as exciting, if not more exciting things than world-class musicians in New York. So to land here and to find these collaborators has been a real blessing.
There you go. Well, I support what you said about Chicago. No shade in New York. You know, I think it's, like I said, it's easy to kind of get into that, well, who's better? And then there's a conversation about pizza. I don't want to get into it. But anyway.
Oh, it's a whole conversation.
It's a whole thing. What we want to focus on is Monday, April 14th at the Jazz Showcase in Chicago. Fantastic room. 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock show. The CD release party performance for Steve Knight and his trio, and we could check out the website, stevenight.net. The new record is called 4 Years Gone. It sounds great, man. That guitar is really, really smooth, really sweet. And Steve Knight, local guitarist and music educator, I say thank you for joining us today, and keep doing what you're doing, man, because you sound great, and lots of great stuff coming your way.
Oh, man, I really appreciate it, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Here we go, once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. It's in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. And Steve, of course, is a local musician, music historian, and artist. And we are getting soulful this week, Steve, because you have the story of this really incredible soul singer. His name is Bobby McClure. And this is certainly one of the people that you've covered where it's like, how do we not know who this person is? Bobby McClure. He should have been, I don't know, bigger, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's sort of my mantra. But then at the same time, you kind of see that, you know, he sort of brushed elbows with tons of famous people, you know, sort of came up in you know, alongside a lot of them. And you're like, huh, why, you know, and he had a long career. He sort of swung back in the 80s, which a lot of, you know, people didn't. So, and then, of course, you hear him and he's got this incredible versatile voice and you're like, why didn't it happen for him, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. He is born in Chicago in 1942, but he's going to move to St. Louis when he's really young, when he's still a baby. And this is sort of the story that we've seen. By age 9, he was singing in church. And as you say, that's where all the best soul artists start out. And he kind of is set apart from the group. It's pretty obvious early on that he's a special talent.
Yeah, he's got this sort of crazy tenor voice, you know, And yeah, I guess he moved from Chicago when he was like two or something like that. But it seems like he, like, I think people sort of almost forget that St. Louis can sort of, you know, be like a sister city or something to us. It's not that far. And if you're sort of like a hard gigging musician, you can kind of bounce between the two a bit. And that's kind of what it seems like he did, because he would come back to Chicago to live and record and at various points in his life. So, you know, I feel like we could claim him, St. Louis could claim him, but then I feel like neither one of the cities claims him, you know? So like he really, you know, yes, should be celebrated more.
Yeah, I agree. And he's got a great voice, like we're talking about here, Bobby McClure. And so he is going to be, again, early on when he's really young, he's going to be singing with some, I don't know, fairly well-known folks, but he starts to meet some people that are going to go on to be, you know, pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, he started singing gospel when he was really young, and he was in this group, the Soul Stirrers, which was led by Sam Cooke, you know.
There you go.
I mean, there you go, you know. And then I actually looked at a bunch of, like, other famous people were in the Soul Stirrers later on. They were sort of like one of those groups that, you know, I think by the time they started recording in the 60s, basically everyone had passed, so many people had passed through the group. But yeah, so, you know, and then he hooked up with this fellow who would be really sort of integral for him, Oliver Sane, who was sort of like a band leader, which, you know, if you look at history, you know, a lot of music history, that is how a lot of these musicians met, you know, or came up, was sort of like part of someone else's much larger ensemble and then sort of rose up and eclipsed them. And he had Little Milton, the sort of famous blues player in the band. And then I guess it seems like blues and soul, R&B, gospel at that time, it was just like, you could do a lot of overlapping gigs, you know? And so the vocal duties ended up going to McClure and a very young Fontella Bass, who would go on to have a lot of fame and would also kind of help McClure with his brush with fame too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the song Rescue Me, that's Fontella Bass right there, you know? I mean,
yeah. Huge.
Yeah, huge hit.
And that's funny enough, that's pretty much the session she did after doing a couple with McClure, and they released a couple songs written by Sane that were pretty big hits, actually, but not on that level.
About how he evolves here. I mean, he's going to go through the 60s. He's going to come out in the 70s, and he's making a bunch of tunes, and he's playing with a bunch of folks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sadly nothing really seemed to work out for him. You know, like, he didn't match those sort of earlier couple hits he had with Miss Fontella. It just seemed like nothing took off. So then, as far as I can tell, and I could not find any more information on this, he worked at a penitentiary in Illinois. And I'm like, in Chicago? Was it like Joliet? You know, where? Because that would be a kind of in between, right? You know,
right.
I was like, I was very curious, but I all my digging I could not find, and then find out exactly where. And then he started his own label in the early 80s, BMAC Records. And I believe that is when he was in St. Louis, but I'm not totally sure, because he bounced around. But, you know, and sort of came back with this very, you know, they call it like modern soul or new soul, like all the current sort of 80s production techniques. There were various artists, you know, like Luther Vandross or you know, Al Jarreau or someone like that in the 80s. I don't think anyone would put those guys down for doing soul music in the context of their time, you know, like with those sort of production. I mean, it doesn't compare to the sort of grittier 70s stuff, but there's a whole world for that stuff. And, you know, you judge on its own terms. And the stuff he's doing is pretty cool. You know, you hear it and you're like, geez, this could have been on the charts right next to El DeBarge, you know, or in that. It's got, like, cool drum machines and good hooks and stuff like that. And it just didn't totally happen for him either, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing. The timing, I mean, not just, you know, the right people that you're meeting at the right time, but also just the time in history and what's cool and what's popular. And just because he was making some soul music in the 80s doesn't mean it wasn't good. And this is so sad. I mean, he passes away in 1992. He's only 50 years old from a stroke. Ugh.
Yeah, and like a Japanese label had just put out an album by him a couple years before that. You know, it always, sometimes these guys are more, I feel like, yeah, I should say he's probably more appreciated overseas than he is here. You know, like the sort of UK Northern Soul scene really likes his early singles. Japan is putting out his 80s albums, you know, like sort of modern soul stuff. So, like, you know, here's clearly a guy that other lands are like, there's something in this or whatever. But yeah, you know, I mean, they keep putting out compilations of his stuff from, you know, various eras in his career. And, you know, the Northern Soul crowd's incredibly devoted, you know, just fans of R&B and stuff are generally very devoted fans. So, you know, he'll always have a place in that world. But, you know, it would be cool if he was as known as a Syl Johnson or an Al Green or, you know, Jerry Butler or someone like that, you know, but he just, maybe someday it'll come.
Yeah, maybe someday. You mentioned in your strip here that Bobby McClure isn't even mentioned in the Bible of the soul genre, the work Chicago Soul. He's not even in there.
I have to admit, I was shocked, and I don't want to shame Mr. Robert Pruder because I bow down to him. Like, he knows everything. That book is, again, my copy is worn ragged of basically consulting it for information over the years. So absolutely no disrespect to the man. But again, I think it's sort of like this thing where, like, you know, he was born here. He took off quickly. It's like, I feel like neither town claimed him, Chicago or St. Louis. You know, he should have like a little star on the walk of fame in both. But, you know, I feel like maybe he wasn't as committed to either, you know, or something. And he seems to have gotten the short shrift in both, you know, like I don't think he's not somehow considered like a top tier Chicago soul artist. And then, you know, obviously I'm not sure in St. Louis exactly how he's considered, but, it's too bad. And I've covered artists before that sort of had, there was actually a soul group called the Shells that were sort of like divided their time between St. Louis and Chicago. And it, you know, it was a thing. It was, you know, I'm pretty sure too, it would be on that sort of, going south, Chitlin circuit, you know, where you would play, you know, these very specific clubs too.
Right. And quick shout out here. You give a shout out in your strip in the Secret History of Chicago Music. Your old roommate who knows a lot about soul music, he helped found the Windy City Soul Club. I mean, if people don't know what the Windy City Soul Club was, can you just briefly tell us what that's all about?
Oh, yeah. It's been going. I believe the only one of his old, like, one of his best friends is this fella, Arit. I believe he's one of the only originals still involved, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, Crazy Night. It's moved around over the years. I believe down at Empty Bottle these days. But yeah, just a crazy packed night of dudes slinging soul 45s and you know, crowds going nuts for sure. And it's been going, Jesus, I don't know, how many years now? 20?
I know. I've been to it. It's awesome. It's so much fun. Yeah. Ugh. And I went to it at the Empty Bottle.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, God, I guess technically the roots of it were in a Club Foot.
Oh, yeah. Club Foot.
They used to do these nights there, and it was just the hardcore Northern Soul people. They would put the baby powder on the floor so you could do your little spins and stuff like that. You couldn't do that at Empty Bottle.
You no. Know?
Like someone would get hurt. You know?
Yeah, but I wouldn't want to do that there.
No. So yeah, it kind of came out of these little soul nights that Ben, my old roommate, and he's a great soul artist too. He records for various labels and completely nails that, like, very old school sound, talented guitar player and everything too. So yeah, I knew I'd hit him up and he would know. I'd be like, Bobby Clear, let me guess, you know, you are a fan of, and he's like, oh God, you know, so there you go.
There it is. Bobby McClure, the story in the Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He also hand draws the image of whoever he is profiling, so you could check that out. Hey, Steve, I appreciate it, man. You rule, and soul music rules, and what a legacy here in Chicago. You stay soulful out there these days, okay?
You too. And one more soulful shout out to Dusty Groove Records, who sponsored this episode of Secret History of Chicago Music in the Reader and will be for the next few months. They actually have an incredible selection of soul and R&B records there too. So I would head over there, or they have a great mail order as well. Not to mention jazz, blues, all good Chicago music and beyond.
Say, I need a younger man, 'cause you just ain't cutting it anymore. Says you wanna make love.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop, show number 962 is done. I say thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN Radio studio. And I say thank you for listening to the show. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.